Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaka. Today, we are bringing you part two of our immigration episode. We hope to put a human side to a very divisive political issue that's happening on Real College Podcast, which starts right now. As students at the University of Minnesota, we see Riverside Plaza towers every day from the West Bank of campus. Many students know that these towers and the neighborhoods surrounding them are home to one of the largest Somali populations in the United States. But they may not know about all the work that is needed to help these new arrivals feel at home in America. In Riverside Plaza, a lot of work is done by the Riverside Plaza Tenants Association. Real College Podcast reporter Ben Hallam went and talked to the staff and volunteers of the Tenant Association to find out more. Here's Willie Hassan, the executive director of the Tenants Association, discussing the history of the building and how the Tenants Association formed.
Riverside Plaza was started in the 70s. It was built by a Minnesota designer, and it's the style of the European design. And it's huge, huge buildings with high towers. Riverside Plaza tenants are predominantly East African, and they are also multicultural. You have different nationalities of American. I think that so many immigrants has gone through, and the East African is the last group that are now here. And in the future, maybe when they go, others will come. One of the tenants that was established association because of the need to help them, these new immigrants that are coming. They spoke for them, and they try to guide them and to help them whenever they have problems, and having them, somebody to support them, because if there's only the management and them, it's always difficulty.
What services does the Tenants Association provide?
We engage in providing services in three different ways. One is that we do advocacy for the families, the tenants, and also we guide them to the information about being a resident here. Also, we provide them senior programs and also adult programs and youth programs, English ESL class, so that they can get jobs and they can communicate to the outside world. Also, citizenship class, we also help them find jobs and we create them jobs for them.
To find out more about the programs the Riverside Plaza Tenants Association helps provide, I sat down with Allie, a University of Minnesota student who volunteers as an English tutor.
I'm an individual tutor, so people can just come to me for whatever they need help with. So I get to help people of all different levels in just doing their homework or just talking to them. Everyone has been very friendly to me, and it's like a very welcoming and warm environment.
What's something you've noticed while working here?
So far, like a lot of the people that I've worked with, like even though they get frustrated, they keep trying. It kind of really sank into me, like, how high the stakes are for some of the students here.
Taking English classes can help prepare residents for the citizenship classes, also offered by the Riverside Plaza Tenants Association through their partner organization, the Cedar Riverside Adult Education Collaborative. To understand how these classes work, I talked with Zaina, a student at Metro State University who volunteers as a citizenship teacher.
It's been very rewarding working here because I'm working mostly with older people, and they are ready or in the process of taking their citizenship test. Every day we come and I help them with what they will encounter on the test and how to take the test and how to prepare for the test in order to become a citizen one day. So we go through civics history, US history, we read, and we do work on their writing skills as well. Just anything and everything that they'll encounter while they're taking the test.
You also went through the citizenship process yourself. What was your experience from the other perspective?
I think I've been here for about 15 years now. I became a citizen in 2013 when I turned 18. I basically knew everything from going to high school. I was still in high school when I took the test, and I remember everything from US history and civics, and also helping my mother with her citizenship test. So it was a breeze for me taking the test, but that's my experience with it, and I thought that would be very helpful when I came here because I already knew exactly what the process was and I went through the whole process.
How would you say your students' experience has differed from your own experience with the citizenship test?
There's a lot of layers to it. You don't just take the 100-question civics test. You have to know English, and you have to be able to speak in English and have to be able to communicate in English. And a lot of people, especially when they come here as adults, it's hard for them to retain the language than it would be for somebody who came here at a young age like myself.
What would you say drives your students to take these classes and work towards their citizenship?
Most people, especially lately, really want to go ahead and get their citizenship because that secures their place in the United States, which they consider their home. And once you have your citizenship, it's very, very, very difficult to revoke your citizenship. But if you're here as you have permanent residency, you have your green card, and you commit a crime, any crime, and you go to jail for about 365 days, therefore, you are eligible to be deported out of the country. So most people, especially with the environment that our political system is in currently, everybody wants to secure their place because this is their home and their kids are here, their families are here, so they want to make sure that they stay here.
In addition to education, the Riverside Plaza Tenants Association helps tenants find employment in America. Here's Willie Hassan explaining that program.
It happens in 2015. I realized that there's a lot of people who are low income and having difficulties with the language or transport. So it came to my mind to make a contact with one of the first, company agency. And I explained to them, I said, look, what about if you hire these people and we help them, for paperwork, applications, and we do the orientation in here, and then you can do the orientation over there. And also I tried them to start a bus for them. So with their cooperation and from our side, we bought a bus for them. We shuttled them to work and back and forth. And at the same time, other companies find out that what we're doing came to the neighborhood also, copied the same idea by bringing buses. And we've been very successful. We started with 25 people, and we end up with 1,500 people. So far, mothers, grandmothers, adults, young people. So, and that's why we are very proud of it. Starting the first group that started, helped them, and some of them really cried when they see their first check, and they feel good about it, having seen the first time having a check in America. So, and start working and defend themselves.
For one final perspective on the Riverside Plaza Tenants Association, I talked to Halul Mohammed, the secretary at the Cedar Riverside Adult Education Collaborative, who's been working for the Tenants Association for 17 years.
It's actually wonderful. They are nice people. And first time I came, they welcomed me. And I'm working this 17 years. That means it's not easy. And they help you because when you are new, you don't know anything. Anywhere to go, they guide you. Where to go to school, how to find the jobs and all that. They're doing a great job, that's what I see.
For the Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Howell.
COVID-19 has highlighted a lot of controversy behind sanctuary cities and their purpose. Sophie spoke to a representative from the Minneapolis Immigrant Action Rights Committee. They're a social justice organization in Minneapolis. She wanted to find out more about our role as a sanctuary city.
The term sanctuary city has been a popular political buzzword since the 2016 United States presidential election. As of November 2017, the Center for Immigration Studies estimates that over 300 U.S. jurisdictions, including cities, counties, and states, have adopted sanctuary policies. But what exactly is a sanctuary city? There is no single overarching definition for a sanctuary city, as policies may vary from one jurisdiction to another. However, sanctuary cities are typically associated with following certain procedures that shelter undocumented immigrants from federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials, known as ICE. I spoke with Daniel Romero, a representative for the Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee, or MIRAC, to find out more. First, I asked how MIRAC defines a sanctuary city.
Yes, I would say MIRAC would define a sanctuary city as a city that is safe for everyone, including immigrants. Sanctuary city would be a city that whose police department would not participate in any way, shape, or form, any government entity at all, any city entity at all, not only the police department, would not participate in any way, shape, or form with enforcing immigration laws. And that includes prohibiting the Minneapolis Police Department from turning over immigrants that they arrest, undocumented immigrants that they arrest, from the Minneapolis Police Department turning those folks over to the Hennepin County Sheriff, which is what the practice is now.
MIRAC has been providing resources for Minnesota's immigrant community since 2006. MIRAC's current advocacy work focuses on their Sanctuary Now platform. This platform, introduced to the Minneapolis City Council in September 2017, revolves around 13 different policy proposals. These policy proposals include funding legal representation for immigrants who are Minneapolis residents who are detained by ICE, and holding legal clinics around the city to aid people to apply for residency or citizenship.
The MIRAC Sanctuary Now platform was introduced on September the 20th at City Hall, and there are 13 proposals that all, each one does, obviously something very different. We are grateful that outgoing Councilwoman Elizabeth Glidden spearheaded one of our proposals, and it was ultimately passed by the City Council around strengthening, clarifying, and streamlining the U visa. U visas are one of the only ways that an undocumented person can get status in any reasonable amount of time under any reasonable amount of criteria, and that U visa certification process requires the Minneapolis Police Department to certify that the applicant, the undocumented applicant, who qualifies as a victim of a crime that's been committed against them on U.S. soil, requires the Minneapolis Police Department to certify that the crime victim, is participating in the prosecution of the investigation and the prosecution of the perpetrators of the crime. And so we're grateful that Councilwoman Glidden spearheaded that and that it has passed.
Another proposal on MIRAC's Sanctuary Now platform is that a Minneapolis municipal ID be made available to all city residents, regardless of immigration or citizenship status.
This is an idea that has been around for a decade or more. Several cities around the country have adopted these municipal IDs, which would give not only the undocumented, but any Minneapolis resident who seeks one, an ID, potentially give them access to a variety of city services, but the protection that a municipal ID provides, particularly for an undocumented person, is that when they're stopped by the police and they're asked for an ID, and when an undocumented person says, "I don't have one," then all of a sudden, in the law enforcement officer's eyes, the alarm bells go up. If they can present a municipal ID, then this issue of immigration status really is taken off the table by them having a municipal ID.
With a new year comes new administration entering the Minneapolis mayor's office. I asked how Mayor Betsy Hodges has reacted to Sanctuary City policies and how adaptations to these policies may be addressed in 2018 as Mayor-elect Jacob Frey enters office.
Well, one thing to remember is that historically Minneapolis has, in the Hodges administration, has shied away from using the term Sanctuary City because in Mayor Hodges' view, she thinks that it overpromises protection, and people don't really understand what sanctuary city policies do. And in fact, there is no clear definition of a sanctuary city. If you go to cities around the country, every set of policies that seek to protect immigrants from the deportation system, from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Each one of those cities has a different policy or a different set of policies. And so Mayor-elect Fry has said some supportive things about the MIRAC Sanctuary, now Sanctuary City platform that we introduced in September, particularly related to the municipal ID proposal that MIRAC has proposed that the city adopt. But Mayor-elect Fry, we urge him, MIRAC urges him to go much further. And in fact, there are concrete proposals that MIRAC has proposed, 13 of them, in September. And we urge Mayor-elect Fry and the entire city council to adopt each of those proposals. Those proposals would go a long way to strengthening our status as a sanctuary city. And Mayor-elect Fry, up to this point, has been mostly silent, but you know, again, he expressed some support for the municipal ID proposal, which would be a significant advancement. So we're just going to have to wait and see about how Mayor Fry handles this going forward.
Progress is being made all around Minnesota to support immigrant rights. In early December, Northfield became the first city in Minnesota to make a municipal photo identification card available for all community members. MIRAC also has plans to have a visible presence at the first meeting of the newly elected Minneapolis City Council in January 2018. To learn more about MIRAC and the Sanctuary Now platform, visit their website at mirac1.wordpress.com. With Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Sophie Dolan.
Sasido Shai is the founder of the UMA Project, which is a community-based project in the Twin Cities that works with Somali youth to create a safe and open community for them. Producer Alex Schumacher sat down with her to learn more about her experience as a refugee here in Minnesota.
I remember that day I was in classroom, and I hear a loud sound, and I wasn't sure what was it. I thought it was like a firework or something like that, but it was not. It was actually the war happening. I remember my teacher running around, closing the windows and asking all the kids to sit down. Then there was another big loud that actually shook the foundation of the school. And I was so shaking and the lights went out. Teacher closed the windows, she closed the door, and she asked all the kids to divide. And she rested in a different corners on the classroom. So in case something happens, we would not be in the same place. I came to America when I was 7 years old. I was born in a country called Somalia. There's many things that you have to overcome, and there's many things that you have to leave in order for you to make yourself who you want to be. One day I decided to look like all the other kids. I was wearing jeans under my skirt, and then I went to dress up, you know, wear everything that I was supposed to wear, leave home. And then went to close by store. I went to the side of the store, take my hijab and everything and put it in my back. And then I had my hair out and then I had jeans. I didn't want to be that different one. I didn't want to be that child who doesn't speak the language, who cover up, who looks different. Because at that time I was doing just because my parents asked me to do it, but I did not do it because it was a principle or something that I believe. It was not. And then the moment I come inside the class, because I usually have black long hair, the moment I come in the classroom, all eyes were on me. The little girls run to me and they touch my hair saying, "Oh my God, she has hair. You know, oh my God, she look beautiful. Oh my God, you look normal." Oh, you know, and that's when I start making friends. After 4 months, my parents find out. and I was in big trouble. It was so difficult for me to go back to where and to becoming the same, because I was scared of the kids maybe not liking me again and all of that. But my parents asked me to do it, and I have to do it. So then I dressed the way I used to, and then I went back. But then funny thing happened. This time, we were still friends, because now they knew me. Two of my girls that were very close asked me, they were both white, they asked me to give them the scarf so they can wear it with me. And then here I bought the next day two kimars, two scarves, give it to them. And then here I have two white girls wearing the same thing that I'm wearing, and that boosts my confidence. That's when I realized that we might look different, but we're not so different. That we're all kids, but we were brought up in different, you know, environment and different cultures. And that showed me that no matter what, humans are human. Whether you pinch them, whether you cut their hand and see their blood, we're all the same. I had to debate with myself to decide who I really want to be. Do I want to be the girl that my parents want me to be, or do I want to be who I want to see myself to be? And that's when I decided to be me, but not the person that my parents are looking for, but be me, because at the end of the day I will be taking care of myself for the long run. Governor actually appointed me 2012 to serve on the Governor's Juvenile Justice Advisory Council. Part of that was to figure out ways that I can advocate for the Somali youth, to figure out what projects or what past practices that we can implement to help the Somali youth. One Trump, two Trump, but there's a lot of Obamas. So you have so many people who are advocating for you, so many people who are welcoming immigrants. So one person or two person is doing something, it's nothing. I just look at, read it, and then just throw out of the window. Because I know majority, if there's one person bad, there's 10 more who are great people, who love me, and will do anything to help me if I need something. Some people might see successful as being, oh, the president of the United States. No, I am successful in my own way. And I'm successful right now because I consider myself successful if I finish school, middle school, high school, college, university. I don't care what you define success, I am successful.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can hear all of our episodes at radiok.org/Real College Podcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and cultural coverage.